issue to the Palestinians. Followers of a Chabad Rabbi Yitzhak Ginzburg are known as the Hilltop Youth. Two of his followers wrote the hugely controversial King's Torah, which was also recommended by Ginzburg. The book states that it is permissible to kill Palestinian children, even babies. There is justification for killing babies if it is clear that they will grow up to harm us. And in such a situation, they may be harmed deliberately and not only during combat with adults. It's not just words. Ginzburg's followers in the so-called Hilltop Youth are said by the Zionist intelligence agency Shin Bet to be responsible for most price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. In 1988, Benjamin Netanyahu famously met with the leader of Chabad in New York, where the sect has its global HQ. Netanyahu has maintained a relationship with Chabad ever since. Here he is addressing them in 2014. These are the forces supported and aided by the US and the UK, unleashed as part of the genocide in Gaza.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Joining us again as our guest contributor today is Amar Kazmi. Amar is an anti-imperialist political activist and a commentator. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and was a political advisor in my parliamentary office from 2017 to 2019. Welcome to the show. David, you know, the Tifa's report there showed that Chabad is deeply embedded in the genocide being conducted by the Zionist entity. I mean, does that strike you as odd for a group that used to be anti-Zionist?
Well, this is an anti-Zionist group, which was always really pro-Zionist. It's a curious thing. So, although it was formally anti-Zionist up until 1967, it was only after 1967 they formally made their kind of peace with Zionism. But back in 1929 in Hebron, they actually stored Haganah weapons in the bank belonging to one of the Hamad followers, and they were engaged in spying on the local Palestinians and passing the information over to the nascent Mossad, you know, prior right. to the creation of the state of Israel. So they've been anti-Zionists who have been collaborating with and using Zionism in order to further the settlement activities which they approved of.
Yeah. Well, Amar, I mean, this group calling for the recolonization of Gaza, I mean, appears to be ultra-Zionist, doesn't it?
Well, certainly, and David just ran through some of the history there. I mean, they did formally at one point oppose the creation of the State of Israel, but this is a thoroughly ultra-Zionist sect. I mean, they believe, Zionism is so fanatical that they believe that the current Israeli state yes. has no real authority against them. They oppose any sort of peace deals. And in the most recent offensive on Gaza, the genocide that's been perpetrated against Gaza, they've had the audacity to set up a Chabad house in the Gaza Strip in December of last year. So this is a thoroughly pro-Zionist organization that's deeply involved and embedded in not just supporting it in terms of words and in terms of ideology, but also materially in terms of fundraising and lobbying.
Well, David, I mean, obviously you've touched on this already, but I just wonder whether you could perhaps explain how this group, along with many other Hasidic groups, I mean, used to be anti-Zionist.
Well, if you listen to Natura Carta, which is the militant anti-Zionist Hasidic group, they say routinely, if you listen to their talks, in 1947, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem said we should not have a Jewish state. And that was the position of almost all the Hasidic sects at the time. Mm. Now, what's happened since then is that they've progressively made their peace with the Zionists. Now, in the case of Chabad, for example, they have a written agreement with the IDF that when they join the IDF, that 25% of the guys who join the IDF can go off to yeshivas for a year, maybe in New York or somewhere, one of their other worldwide offices. Whereas some of the other Hasidic groups are still sufficiently anti-Zionist that they refuse to allow their children when they reach 18 to serve in the IDF. But nevertheless, so there's an ongoing process there where the IDF are trying to encourage them to join. And they have throughout the West Bank and the illegal settlements, they have these what are known as IDF yeshivas, where they're allowed to go and do Torah study. And then they also have to go and kill a few Palestinians on the weekend. So it's that kind of arrangement. And that's how it works. And that's what's compromised almost all of the Hasidic sects now. There's only one, the Satmar, which is quite a large one, which remains formally anti-Zionist. Mm. But it's been a process from really the 1930s to today of compromising that anti-Zionism and bringing the kind of ultra-Zionism of the Hasidic sects into the service of the Zionist entity.
Amara, Latifa mentioned in the report there about the so-called price tag attacks which are associated with this group. Arnim, just say a word or two about that, will you?
Well, these price tag attacks are essentially revenge attacks against Palestinians who are involved or perceived to have been involved in acts of resistance against the Zionist regime. We often hear in the West that, you know, these are these extremist settlers acting sort of their own volition, but actually they act as an extension of the Israeli regime, as militias for them. They're essentially completely unaccountable. They have total impunity. Often they're actually aided and abetted by the IDF in the West Bank. And the Israeli intelligence agency Shin Bet has said that the vast majority of these people involved in these attacks are linked to this extremist faction based in the Yitzhar settlement. In particular, there's actually a Chabad-linked yeshiva, a Jewish seminary, in that settlement. So we see that it's really these individuals who are involved in it, but of course they're completely supported by the Israeli regime.
Mm. And David, what about this King's Torah's justification for killing Palestinian babies? What's that about?
Well, I mean, when you read this for the first time, you sort of you think, can this be true? But when you look back at it, you know, their actual main theological tome, the Tanya, describes Gentiles as being having husks for souls, and they have animal souls, they're not fully human. And of course, you know, it's a small step from deciding that to say, well, actually, in that case, you can kill children who are not Jewish. And in the case of Palestinians, the key question is, will they grow up to challenge us in the future? Of course, something which you can't tell about a baby, but nevertheless, they can tell, and they can tell that any Palestinian baby is a threat to them in the future, and they can be engaged regardless of whether you're trying to kill their parents or not. You can just kill the babies by themselves. And this is the depths of the horror of the philosophy and the ideas of this sect. And of course, we see that enacted every day in Gaza today and tomorrow and yesterday, and that's what's been going on here. This is the ideological justification for the direct killing and assassination. Sometimes we've seen through by Israeli snipers direct shots through the head of children, and this is the ideological justification.
Yeah, incredible. Well, Amar, I mean, Netanyahu has been a prominent and very long-term presence in the Zionist power structure. I mean, just say a little, will you, though, about his connection with the Chabad?
Well, you know, if you look at Netanyahu and his sort of family background, it's quite clear that he has a very long-term connection with sort of, you know, the revisionist Zionist movement in general. His father was an aide to Jabotinsky. Mm. After Jabotinsky died, you know, Netanyahu's father continued to work on the revisionist Zionist movement. You know, in a hostage recovery raid in the 1970s, Netanyahu was injured. His brother Jonathan was killed, and afterwards Netanyahu set up an institute called the Jonathan Foundation, the Jonathan Institute, which helps to research, you know, so-called terrorism, and helped to sort of give birth in the mid-1980s to this idea of Islamic terrorism.
Right.
And you know, so in terms of promoting these sorts of ideas and being associated with Zionist extremism, and also being associated with Chabad, this is something that Netanyahu has been associated with for many, many decades.
Right. Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after our second report, which looks at the worldwide distribution of Chabad offices, its links to literal Nazis, and its deplorable fundraising activities.
In December, it was revealed that a Chabad group in the UK was fundraising to support the genocide in Gaza. Rabbi Aryeh Sufrin of Chabad claimed back in October that Hamas is worse than ISIS, in full conformity with Zionist entity Talking Points. He also disclosed that his son is a British recruit to the occupation forces and was in occupied Palestine at the time. The Chabad appeal read, "Vital equipment needed by the IDF. Funds raised will go direct to equipment needed by Aaron Dov Sufrin's reserve unit up in the north of Israel and support units." Aaron Dov Sufrin is, of course, the son of the rabbi, serving actively in the genocidal occupation forces. Chabad Lubavitch is an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sect which also happens to be a genocidal cult. It originates in Lubavitchy in Russia near the border with Belarus. It's a global movement with more than 5,000 offices in over 100 countries and in all 50 states of the US. It even has offices in seemingly unlikely places like China, Belarus, Tunisia, Morocco, and Venezuela. It has prominent supporters in many places. The new Argentinian president is a Chabad devotee. Donald Trump even donated to Chabad, though not as much as his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has played a pivotal role in the normalization of the Zionist entity. Obviously, Chabad has been highly organized in Ukraine, and Chabad followers were amongst those recruited in the Nazi Azov Battalion, which we should remember was co-founded by a former member of the Israeli occupation forces. Palestine Declassified previously reported on how Ukrainian Jewish oligarch Igor Kolomoisky bankrolled Chabad in Ukraine as well as the Nazi Azov and IDER battalions. Back in the UK, there are more than 100 Chabad groups or offices. It flies under the radar and is widely regarded as well-meaning, if a little eccentric. In reality, it is an extremist group which is building support for genocide in the UK. Ironically, the Community Security Trust has aided Chabad, giving them security advice after an edition of Palestine Declassified exposed some of their activities. The CST has educating about extremism as one of its charitable objectives, but it is unwilling to educate us about the extremism of Chabad. There's a very good reason for that. Gerald Ronson, which created and runs the CST, is himself an extremist and has been supporting Chabad for more than half a century. Here he is in 2013 as a guest of honor at one of their events.
Chabad Lubavitch UK Ambassador's Award presented to Gerald Ronson CBE and Dame Gail Ronson for their friendship and support over four decades.
Zionist extremists are widely distributed in the UK and form a mutually supportive network. This is a key element of the justification and support for genocide in the UK.
Amar, I suspect a lot of people in this country would be absolutely shocked that a British Chabad group is raising funds for the Zionist occupation forces. I mean, a British Chabad group is doing that. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Well, I mean, people I think would be shocked to find out that this organization has, you know, roughly around 100 branches across the entirety of the UK, has 1,000 branches in the United States, at least one in every single state, has, I think, about 5,000 branches worldwide. This is an incredibly large organization that wields a significant amount of power in terms of its lobbying capacities, its fundraising capacities, and it's really never spoken about publicly despite the amount of influence that it has. And of course, it poses as this very innocent, well-meaning organization. But then we see that it's raising funds for the Israel occupation forces. It's 100% ideologically behind the genocide against the people of Gaza. As we heard earlier in the program, we have statements saying that it's legitimate to kill Palestinian babies. I mean, I think if people in Britain actually understood what this organization was, the sort of depth that it has in Britain, they'd be deeply, deeply shocked.
Well, it's certainly got some reach, hasn't it, David? I mean, in 100 countries. But I was pleased to say that I don't believe they've got any base in Cuba. I mean, is that right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are bases in Venezuela, in revolutionary Venezuela. They have branches in Beijing and Shanghai and other places in China. Many branches in Russia, too, as you perhaps wouldn't expect. In Cuba, there isn't an official base there, but they do have a foothold. They have a they have a follower there who acts as if they are a Chabad house in Havana, but they haven't formally got an office there. That's because, of course, the Communist Party has not allowed that, which is a good thing too. But they have spread over 100 countries. I mean, it's truly extraordinary. That's many more countries than have a formal Zionist presence by the Zionist movement itself, which is around about 35 or 40 countries. But nevertheless, this is an ultra-Zionist group spreading ultra-Zionist messages all around 100 countries. It's a truly extraordinary reach for an organisation, and it flies so far under the radar that hardly anyone's even heard of it.
Mm. Well, hopefully we hope to shed a bit of light on them. But Amar, I mean, wonder what you could say a word or two about Jared Kushner and his role in the normalisation process.
Yes, I mean, Jared Kushner, firstly, is someone who is very close to Chabad. He's personally donated thousands of dollars to Chabad, and during the Trump regime, he was given this sort of informal role to promote normalisation in the Gulf. We saw him as a very prominent public figure in the so-called Abraham Accords in 2020, in which Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates formalized publicly the sort of diplomatic relationship they'd already been secretly having with Israel, but formally normalized with Israel. And Kushner was very involved in that, also in Morocco, and of course as well in terms of lobbying the Saudi oligarchy, which was very close to reaching a normalization agreement with Israel before the events of the 7th of October last year. And, you know, after leaving the White House, I believe a hedge fund associated with him received $2 billion US dollars from the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund. So this is someone who's been deeply involved in that process and is closely linked to Chabad. Yeah.
Well, I mean, another sort of extraordinary revelation relating to this organisation, David, is that a number of them have apparently signed up to fight in the Nazi Azov battalion in Ukraine. I mean, can that really be true?
Well, I'm afraid it is true, Chris. I mean, the thing that you've got to understand about Chabad in Ukraine is that in the UK and in the US is an official Zionist movement, and then there's Chabad. And the official Zionist movement mainly runs the organised Jewish community. In Ukraine, the organised Jewish community is mainly run by Chabad, and that's true, actually, also in Russia. And so what you see is that when Kolomoisky, the oligarch, the Ukrainian oligarch, who I think we can talk about a little bit later, when he is involved in funding something like Chabad, he's also involved in funding Azov and the Idar battalions. And what you see then is you saw in the film that there are photographs from Zionist papers of Chabad followers joining up to fight the Russians, and of course some of these are joining up with the Azov battalion. Incredible.
Well, it is incredible. I mean, and I wonder what you make of that, Amar. I mean, David mentioned there that Igor Kolomoisky involved in funding the Azov battalion and a huge Chabad community in Dnipro as well. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it?
Yes, well, I mean, you know, Kolomoisky is, of course, is fantastically rich oligarch, maybe not so much anymore after being sanctioned and having some of his funds taken away from him in London as well, you know. But he's this rich oligarch with, you know, Cypriot Israeli citizenship. And after the 2014 Maidan coup in Ukraine, he was given control of the Dnipro Oblast, which is, you know, a very strategically important region in southeastern Ukraine. And he helped to develop and create several armed militias. He helped to support, as we just heard, financially, the Nazi-linked or neo-Nazi, you could even say, ideologically, Azov and Ada battalions.
Yeah.
And, you know, as well as that, he's also helped to fund Chabad extensively, helped to fund a Chabad Jewish community center, which is said to be the largest in the world. This is a deeply nefarious figure, deeply corrupt individual. You know, he is actually wanted by the U.S. Justice Department. He and his family can't travel there. He was actually put in pre-trial detention in Ukraine very recently on charges of money laundering and fraud. So this is someone who's used his wealth, got it in nefarious ways potentially, and has used it to help support this movement.
Another interesting funder, David, of course, is Gerald Ronson, isn't it? I mean, the guy who runs the Zionist Community Security Trust, which, you know, is adjacent to or works with Mossad. I mean, this is the organisation that claims that anti-Semitism is skyrocketing. I mean, what do you make of all that?
So their most recent report on the skyrocketing nature of anti-Semitism, you know, of course, counts people shouting Free Palestine as being an indication of anti-Semitism, shows the utter bankruptcy of their research. But we should also be looking much more closely at Ronson's charitable ventures, which of course have been involved for more than 50 years now in supporting Chabad, this extremist group. The CST says in its charitable objectives that it's supposed to educate the public about extremism, but they won't be doing any educating at all about Chabad, because they don't regard the extremism of Chabad as being extremism at all. And that indicates the deep rot at the heart of the CST, an organisation which gets some 15 million a year from the Home Office, and I think he's also got an extra 3 million on top after October the 7th from our dearly departed Home Secretary Suella Braverman. So this is a deeply, deeply corrupt organisation engaged in promoting effectively anti-Palestinian racism on a daily basis.
I mean, and you know, Gerald Ronson's involvement is rather curious, to say the least, isn't it?
This is the guy who was, remember, he was put in jail for fraud as part of the Guinness fraud scandal. And he in his autobiography, he bangs on about radical Islam and all various Islamophobic stuff in his book. And this is an organisation we're supposed to, the public is supposed to trust in dealing with anti-Semitism.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time again. So let me thank our guest, Amar Kazmi, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Our greetings and salams and respect and salutations, first of all, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, and to you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to delve a little bit deeper into challenges and problems that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to raising your lovely, dear teenagers. And alhamdulillah, in the studio, we have our dear guest, an expert of the program, Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. His specialty is Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, so we've been dealing with the issue of hard children that who are very, you know, challenging. You know, you lose your temper with them. You work so many hard, long hours to provide for them, to meet their needs, their financial needs, their material needs. And after all, you're a human being yourself. And it's really hard sometimes to have someone who, you know, and especially children and teenagers these years, that their expectations are so high and they are not thankful. You provide a lot for them, and at the end of the day, they say, I never asked for it. You did it yourself. So, I mean, a lot of we parents do see these things from our children. So in this program, Sayyid Naqawi is going to share with us 7 ways to tackle, you know, these children and to establish a very fruitful, communicative relationship with your teenager. Is that right?
Yes, there's a, for that communication, assertive communication that we were saying, you need to keep your temper. Don't lose your temper. But there are 7 steps to that. I mean, as an advice, as you said, that we can seek advice from people who know.
So the points that you're telling us, are they based on Islamic teachings or psychological?
I mean, basically, teachings? When we talk about Islamic teachings, many of them, as we say, are irshadi. They guide us towards what other people, many different experts may understand for themselves. Because sometimes the teachings in Islam are based on some of the human experiences. I mean, whatever human experience as a result of advancement of the human knowledge and wisdom.
You mean experimental sciences?
Even philosophical issues and experimental issues, all of them go, whatever the treasure of human knowledge is that we have today, much of it is endorsed by Islam and its teachings. I mean, many of the things that Islam told us, we could have, at that time, maybe it was not easy for us to discuss them. Today, we realize that many of the things that were there in the treasure of Islamic teachings is something which human beings can discover, but it will take time.
Right.
So now we need to, you know, we find that all of these things are embedded in Islamic teachings. I mean, when you talk about, when we're going to say here that you need to let your teenager know that you demand respect, you want him to respect you, you respect yourself, something which Islam teaches us, human dignity. So you need to show that we are dignified. We, both of us, are dignified human beings. Human beings are dignified. And dignity has to be respected. Dignity has to be maintained. This is what Islam is telling us. So in the same way,
I just remembered the story where the parent brought their child to the Prophet so that he would, I don't know, name the child or say azan, and the child urinated on the Prophet, and the parents got so angry at that little child, and the Prophet said, no, keep your calm, and I can easily wipe out or wash out this dirty clothes of mine, but the scar that you will leave on the personality or character of your child will never be removed. So this means takrim, or honoring or respecting your child, that starts from much, much before the child is born, and it continues all along until they turn into
exactly.
adults.
So basically, human beings, Islam has come to establish and promote the dignity of mankind, isn't it? So it is basically karramna bani adam. So if we want to teach our children to be dignified, they need to respect me as a human being also, not because of, for my sake, because Allah has made me a human being, and the child should know that I'm a human being and he is a human being, and that equality has to be maintained. I respect him, he respects me.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
Ya muqdi al-khayrat, يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We're talking about the fact that one of the ways to establish a good connection with your child is to honor them, to respect them in practice.
And to teach them to respect yourself also, yeah. Both ways. It should be, number one, respect, setting the boundaries to show this is how you respect me, mm-hmm. and show him how to respect yourself.
Do you believe that, you know, some psychologists these days say that if others don't respect you, sometimes it's because you don't respect yourself.
Exactly. That's true.
The tricky point.
That is a tricky. Not allowed to backbite someone behind his back, speak bad of him behind his back. It's also wrong to be such a person that people talk about you and lift fingers at you. And they try to dishonor you. You have to maintain your honor, your dignity, yourself. If you are causing people to go behind your back and talk about you in a negative way,
you're to be blamed.
We are ourselves to be blamed. So we need to maintain that dignity in any case, our own dignity and the dignity of our children. And this should be, number two, based on an equal footing. And number three, so number one, dignity, number two, equality in this dignity. Neither I yell at him or shout at my child, nor does he yell it back at me. We both have to be polite and kind to each other and love each other. But I have to take the lead. I have to show the way. Number three, whatever we say, don't beat behind the bush. Directly. Mm-hmm. Communicate what you want, what your request is, what you expect from your child.
But at the right time, not when he's angry, true. Hungry, tired.
True, very true. And then you should remain very much focused on what you're saying. Don't, you know, go this way and that way. Whatever you want, be focused on it, and keep the doors open for negotiations. Maybe he comes back and says, "Oh, I don't accept what you're saying. I don't want to do what you're saying." Okay, let's leave it for another day. Let's come back again. If he says or she says, "I'm not going to accept what you're saying," then you say, "Then get lost."
I say, you have to clean your room. I have this problem with my own daughter. Clean your room. For example, she promises to do it, but she never does it. Or she says, I don't want to do it. So
she's a teenager. If she's a teenager, then assert yourself and say, no, this has to be done. Mm-hmm. And then you have to try again and again to make that and, you know, enforce that. And you need to, that negotiation, I mean, you shouldn't break up all your communications. And stop and lose hope in it. No, you need to start again sometime.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters in faith. We're talking about seven steps that you should take in order to make right the relationship or the communication that you have with your teenager. How many points have you mentioned so far?
Number one, value yourself, dignity, mm-hmm. maintain your dignity. Number two, promote that in an equal way, on an equal footing between yourself and your child. You should respect him and he should respect you.
Mutual respect.
Number three, whatever you want to say, it should be directly mentioned.
Don't beat around the bush.
Number four, it should be focused on one thing that you want to enforce. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a pushback, there's some problem, don't let the communication break down. You should always maintain that position of calmness. And maintain your cool and say, okay, we'll talk about it another day. But you have to come back to it again to reinforce that. And then you also, when you set a rule and when you set a boundary, you need to also show them, tell them what the consequences will be and follow through with those consequences. For example, you say, oh, if you don't do this, then I will not take you out for a walk, I will not take you out for a movie or whatever reward you wanted to give. Mm-hmm. You deprive the child of that reward. You like something for breakfast, I will only give you what you want for breakfast if you do this, mm-hmm. if you tidy your room, if you whatever. And then if the child is doing what you have asked, then you should praise him or her.
Reward the good job.
Praise is also important. Mm-hmm. Praise. Only rewarding, but also praising.
Praise the person.
And if you don't, if things didn't work out as they were planned, then again, you should come back again and say, okay, no problem. We weren't successful this time. Let's try again. Mm-hmm. So even in case what you expected did not work out, then you need to come back and try again.
You know, perhaps sometimes some tasks are seen very unmanageable to the child, or it's like the child thinks it's a very hard, difficult thing to do. So you can break it into different pieces and say, okay, so today you can do this part. For example, if it's with regards to cleaning the room, you can, for example, make the bed, exactly. And I will help you to put your dirty laundry away. Or, you know, you can offer help, and little by little you can establish that good trait in them by breaking that big one single whole task into different segments or dimensions, and let the child, you know, it's the same way where when we adults have to do something something and we keep postponing it because we think, oh, it's too hard, I'm not going to, you know, you feel it's too difficult to be handled, so you just keep postponing it. But they say, break it down. Just take, for example, just do 5 minutes of the work today, do 10 minutes tomorrow. Once you break it, ultimately, gradually, you'll have the work done.
That's a good way, exactly. That should be the case, and we should be teaching ourselves, educating ourselves and our children. But we need to help them. We need to make them to sort the issues themselves. They need to face the challenges. You need to give them the chance to solve their problems themselves.
Thank you so much. This is the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of questions to ask, or you have concerns or comments with regards to our program. Feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And you can listen to our programs at parstoday.ir. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. Date January 23, 1983. Topic: Importance of Propagating Islamic Culture. Our cultural program propagation on the radio and television must be more because the situation now is such that the villager who is engaged in farming in the wilderness also listens to the radio broadcast, and in some places even television is available. You know that there is a lot of foreign propaganda against us. By means of propagation of Islamic culture, you must give a reply to the lies that they spread. Resistance and defense of the identity of Islam and Islamic Republic.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. About role of women in Iran's revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "It is today when all segments of society have a say in their own affairs, in the affairs of the country and the political affairs of the state. It is today when all people of the nation, whether the esteemed ladies or the brothers, have a say in determining their own destiny." Here, Imam rahmatullah alayhi is talking about the role that women had in the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The massive presence of people from all walks of life was an obvious characteristic of the Islamic Revolution. However, the role of women has been very significant and effective in this regard. Being wary of the humiliation imposed by the regime of Shah, women rushed to the field of struggle against the regime once they heard the life-inspiring call of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women have increasingly taken part in different domains such as politics, culture, economy, sciences, literature, art, sports, and so on. They have been present in every domain to defend the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. Women take part in different demonstrations and other social and political events. The best example of women's responsible presence in the scene was displayed during the 8-year war, which claimed over 7,000 martyrs among women in defense of the country and the Islamic Republic. The insight of Imam rahmatullah alayhi examines the heart of the matters and explains them to common people with a simple rhetoric. In his point of view, women are in charge of the purification and constructiveness of the society. The corruption of human societies, that was the Western societies in particular, not abiding with the moral principles, stem from the ignoring the motherhood's responsibilities. The happiness and the wretchedness of nations and countries have profound and genuine ties with the presence of women. A woman can be the origin of the happiness for a society, and the blessings of her being can establish the endurance of the society. The opposite of this situation is true as well. Based on Imam Khomeini's view, the fundamental role of women in the survival of societies has been greater than the role of men. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Spring of the Truth. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Every
night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illa
Hello and welcome to another edition of Face to Face. I'm Matti Apusian. Today in the studio we are joined by one of the members of the political bureau of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Ali Abu Shaheen. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Hello, wassalam, yatikum alf afia.
Dr. Abu Shaheen, my first question is that after 4 months of Israeli onslaught on Gaza, what is the field situation of the resistance factions in targeting occupation forces and making their incursions into Gaza costly in terms of human casualties?
Of course, the resistance today is still fighting with all valor and heroism in the field against this enemy, even though more than 135 days have passed since this aggression and this ground and aerial offense. This enemy has not spared any means in its onslaught against Gaza, its people, resistance, civilians, hospitals, buildings, and mosques. But the resistance is still in a very good condition and carrying on with its duty with all the valor and ability, because the basic element possessed by the resistance against the enemy is morale and fighting element of the Palestinian people, their steadfastness, and the spirit of the Palestinian resistance. This spirit is still there. On the contrary, it becomes more challenging and more persisting day after day. If we monitored the path of the resistance and its performance in the field since the outset of the ground attack up to now, we can realize that its performance is much better than the beginning of the aggression. In other words, after the first truce, the resistance performance became better than the battle in the north and Khan Yunis, despite all these challenges, sacrifices, and passing of all this time.
The resistance is still controlling the battlefield, possessing military tactics that enable it to inflict huge losses on the enemy's army. The Palestinian fighters are capable of confronting their enemy from zero distance, despite the lack of balance of power and the unequal battle.
The enemy is superior in the capabilities that it possesses.
But the Palestinian fighters are superior in their readiness to sacrifice themselves, seeking martyrdom in front of an alien.
Strange, an invading Israeli soldier who came to invade Gaza, while the Palestinian fighter is the son of this land, ready for any kind of sacrifice. So this situation helped the resistance to adapt to the new reality. Whenever the Israeli enemy fails in the field, it instantly changes his plans and tactics. Therefore, the resistance movement changes its military tactics and plans also. The resistance movement applied some specific tactics in the north, Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun, totally different from its tactics in Khan Yunis. And for sure, these tactics will be different should there be developments in Rafah. So the resistance is adapting itself to the battlefield in front of all Israeli plans. The Israeli enemy failed in the north, suffering huge losses. When the American Defense Minister Austin visited the Zionist entity, he said in a press conference to his Israeli counterpart Gallant, "I advised the Minister of War and the Israelis to evaluate their experience in the north after the losses they suffered, and to evaluate their military tactics in the south as well." When the enemy changed the tactics, the resistance movement did the same. I would like to inform you that the resistance is highly prepared on the ground, ready to carry on fighting for months after months. It still has the ability to fight and has the capabilities through which it can inflict losses on this enemy.
Thank you, Mr. Abu Shaheen. Now, speaking of the resistance, recently there have been viral videos on social media showing, and even on mainstream news, showing Israeli soldiers infiltrating into hospitals and then targeting resistance for forces and fighters, and also arresting people. Now, my question is, where are the resistance factions during these incursions?
First, this proves the falsehood of the Israeli enemy's claims. The enemy claims that the resistance movement is utilizing hospitals as centers to launch its guerrilla work and launching missiles. These are lies. The enemy said that the Palestinians are utilizing mosques and hospitals in order to justify its action in attacking them and committing massacres against our people. Then the enemy said that the resistance movement is using the civilians as human shields to have an excuse in committing massacres against the civilians. Today, the resistance movement has proved that the Israelis failed in finding resistance fighters inside the hospitals. As you mentioned, this fact proves that our fighters do not exist inside humanitarian facilities in general, and the hospitals in particular. This is our strategy, and these are the convictions of the resistance movement, to avoid using these buildings for their guerrilla attacks, particularly the hospitals and clinics.
So what was another lie from our enemy?
The second subject, our fighters confronted our enemy soldiers while they were advancing towards various hospitals. It is true that the resistance movement did not defend the hospitals, and the reason is very clear, because they were not stationed in them at all. The main goal of the resistance fighters was to engage with the enemy, trying to delay its troops and inflicting heavy losses on them. The enemy lost a lot until his soldiers managed to control these buildings. The resistance fighters succeeded in delaying the enemy, but it did not succeed in stopping its advancement because the resistance movement is not a big military army, while the enemy's firepower is greater than that of the resistance. The enemy has tanks, airplanes, fire density, and fire belts. So the resistance is not required to not allow the enemy to advance by meters or steps, otherwise this would be recorded on the resistance. How was the enemy able to advance within the Gaza borders? This is a natural case. The Israeli enemy is capable of penetrating here and there and arrest our people, but it cannot control the Palestinian geography. Its soldiers are still faltering within the geography of Gaza. The soldiers enter the north, then they withdraw, and in Khan Yunis it is the same condition. The reason is that the enemy failed in controlling this geography and suffering big losses in any penetrated operation or a ground offense.
Great. Now, moving on to the targeting of civilians, Palestinian civilians. These days, Rafah in southern Gaza Strip has turned into a flashpoint in the onslaught, Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Now, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has time and again threatened to launch a ground invasion into Rafah. In case of such an attack, what would the response of the resistance be?
Yes, with regard to Rafah, we are putting this possibility in front of us, which means that we assume that the Israeli enemy might attack Rafah city through a ground offensive. The air strikes have been going on for a while now.
Since the Israeli aggression, there has been no safe place in Gaza. This is a matter I have got to clarify.
These Israeli lies, which are covered and supported by the American administration and unfortunately the international community that bears a historical responsibility for every drop of Palestinian blood, I can say they are all partners with this enemy, or at least they have kept silent covering the crimes while the Israeli enemy never stopped targeting any place in the Gaza Strip. Is there any safe place in Gaza from the north to the center, to Gaza City, to Khan Yunis and the south of the Strip? Now, the attacks have reached Rafah. Since the outset of the aggression, the Israelis have been attacking several places in Rafah governorate. Therefore, we are expecting a big military operation. The Israeli government has already taken a decision to launch the operation, but it is reluctant due to the international pressure. Today, there is a global discontent as a result of the massacres and crimes being committed by the Israeli enemy, which means a kind of international distancing from Israel. The world today is saying enough is enough. The prolonged battle against our people couldn't be tolerated from the international community anymore, particularly the global civil society. The American administration is a part of this aggression. Therefore, this causes pressure on the American administration that is assuming prophecy for the Western civilization and keen on tolerance, peace, the humanitarian values, and human rights. All these lies intend intended to reorganize our region after the 90s of last century under the pretext of slogans of democracy and confronting dictatorship. America came to Iraq, Afghanistan, and the region claiming that it intended to reorganize the region in accordance to Western civilization. Today, this allegation has been proven false. All the world now knows that the mass has fallen from America's ugly face and the real criminal face that is dealing with the international law with double standard has taken its place. This international law has been never applied to Israel, but rather to the Palestinian and the oppressed nations. America has been utilizing its veto power in the Security Council to refuse ceasefire. American influence appears even in the International Court of Justice through refraining from issuing a resolution binding Israel to an instant ceasefire and halting its aggression. Despite positive stances for International Court of Justice towards South Africa's lawsuit, the matter did not reach a decision to demand an immediate ceasefire. That was as a result of America's influence in the world. Today, this stance is putting America in a sticky situation, an embarrassment. No doubt this matter will affect America's interests, changing it to an undesirable country in the region from the nations who will accuse it for the responsibility of being a partner in the ongoing crimes and massacres. Therefore, the American administration is trying its best to avoid such embarrassment by pressurizing Israel to commit its crimes quietly without noise. We're not saying neither America is a partner nor supporting Israel, but rather we say it is leading the battle since the beginning of the aggression by giving the green light for the military tactics and plans. With regard to the Rafah case, American administration is not against Israel's plans to attack Rafah, but rather it wants from its protege to come up with a precise plan to avoid any casualties among civilians. Unfortunately, we've heard this from several states which expressed their objection to such stance from American administration. Therefore, we are expecting Israel to change the political status quo in Gaza due to its failure in achieving its declared goals in the war, such as eliminating the resistance movement, freeing its captives. So Israel has two choices, either to accept the victory by the resistance movement and its conditions, or escape forward from Gaza's quagmire, either to the south of Lebanon or Rafah by launching its aggression in a way that does not anger the Americans. Should this expectation crystallize, our people are in full readiness to confront the Israelis, as they have done in the North Khan Yunis and Gaza. We're telling you, be confident that these Israelis cannot achieve their goals should they decide to go ahead with their plan in carrying out more aggression and attacks against Rafah. They will face the same results they experienced in the North or Khan Yunis and will not gain any additional results, neither in the field nor in the political arena.
Okay, Mr. Abu Shaheen, you say that Palestinians, no matter what, are prepared to fight against these Israeli forces. Now, my question is regarding the rocket barrages launched from the Gaza Strip toward, occupied territories by Israel. Why have they stopped?
Yesterday, or the day before yesterday, Al-Quds Brigades announced bombing and firing rocket bursts. This firing never stopped. It is not true, and its pace has become less comparing to the past. Of course, this is related to the realities in the battlefield. We're speaking objectively. It is true we mentioned the steadfastness of our fighters and their capabilities in confronting the enemy, but we also talk about the fierceness of the battle and an unprecedented fight by Palestinian fighters during their history against the Israelis. So we have entered this battle totally aware of its difficulties. Frankly, the case is related to the tactics by our fighters. Today, the resistance movement knows very well when to launch its missiles and whether they will be useful or useless. Currently, the issue of the missile effect has become more morale than material because the engagement became direct with enemy soldiers from zero distance. Therefore, our fighters proved that they're capable of launching missiles despite all atrocities from the enemy. New Year's Eve, the missiles' bursts from the north were unprecedented against Tel Aviv. Later, these attacks continued, but at a slower pace. This matter has a link with the tactics by the resistance movement, but it hasn't been dropped from our fighters' agenda. Or, for instance, we say missile launching has been halted, but rather the pace of launching missiles has become different from the past. There are fighting tactics which have the priority and more importance in addition to their costs. So the resistance movement decides using the best and most effective method and tactic in fighting, be it a rifle or even by Al-Yassin, shells or missiles. In other words, the choice depends on the reality of the clash in the field.
Talking about the casualties that you said, inflicting more casualties on Israeli forces in case of a ground invasion into Rafah, what's your assessment? What are your estimates of losses inflicted on the occupation forces in case of such an invasion?
Regarding the losses incurred by the enemy in the battlefield since the outset of the aggression, I can say the enemy experienced many losses, to the extent it cannot now hide the number of the dead soldiers or the losses in its armored vehicles. But it is trying to minimize the effect of these losses in an attempt to preserve its soldiers and the settlers' morale. There are many differences currently within the Israeli officials. Once we hear that some sources in the army have